chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
As the saying goes, if you don't have anything nice to say, come sit by us. Today we are going to talk with one of my favorite people to talk with and gossip with and talk shit with. My mother.
Yay, Esther's here.
Don't believe everything you hear about me.
We are joined today by Esther Cohen, my mother, the woman who made me the crazy lady I am. Well, Janelle, what are we talking about today?
Oh, Eliza and Miss Esther, we are talking about one of the great Southern rom-coms that does it right. I'm just going to do a spoiler for you all. It's just fabulous. We're talking about 1989 Steel Magnolias.
Woo!
Woohoo! Yes, claps, claps, claps.
One of our personal favorites in this house.
Absolutely.
All right, so here is your Google summary. Steel Magnolias, the year of our Lord, 1989. Malin, played by Sally Field, is the mother of bride-to-be Shelby Eatonton, played by Julia Roberts. And as friend of Truvy Jones, played by Dolly Parton, fixes the women's hair for the ceremony, they welcome a helping hand from aspiring beautician Annelle DePue DeSoto, played by Daryl Hannah. Diabetic Shelby has a health scare, which is averted, but doesn't bode well for her hopes of having children. Time passes, and the women and their friends encounter tragedy and good fortune, growing stronger and closer in the process. Esther and Eliza, that's what Google says Steel Magnolias is about. But what would you say Steel Magnolias is really about?
I would say that Steel Magnolias is about a particular group of women in a particular place. But I think that it can be expanded to many women that I know, particularly women of my generation. And it's about friendship, but it's really about loyalty.
Mm.
Because not everybody acts like a good friend throughout the entire film. And not everybody is kind to each other through the entire film, which is what you sort of think about when you think about friendship. But they are all incredibly loyal to each other. And that extends not just to the particular group of women, but they are loyal to the men around them. And the men around them are really worth a conversation.
Yes, I definitely want to get into that.
Absolutely. You know, the interesting thing when you sort of dive into this movie is that it was based on a play. And the play has a structure which we'll, I'm sure, talk about at some point, is not an unusual structure where it's just the women in the story talking and you never actually see the men. And so to translate it into a movie, they had to actually introduce the male characters because they're showing the scenes rather than just talking about them. And I actually think this movie does that really well. I think it did a good job of expanding into the town that this story takes place in. But it is interesting because you're still seeing all the men from the women's perspective.
Yeah, I think you can tell from a writing standpoint that this play was adapted by the playwright because it's clearly done by someone who understands both what a play is supposed to do and what a film is supposed to do. And in addition to us in the play only ever seeing the women and talking about the men, we also in the play are only ever at the beauty salon, which for a play makes a whole lot of sense for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. The unity of space, the unity of time, all of those classic Aristotelian unities, which I know our viewers are, or rather our listeners are very familiar with, right? But then in
yes,
a film.
But me as a drama major, I'm very familiar with them. So thank you for bringing them up.
Hey, you know, we love to throw it out for the theater fans in the audience and our guests who are theater people almost always. But then the film, you're right, Eliza and Esther, it's really good that the men come in. It gives us this kind of wider sense of the world that a film can give us through visuals and through characters instead of through the dialogue, which is really the art of a play.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of moments I was thinking as we were rewatching it this time around that tell the story with no dialogue really well. You know, that's one of the beautiful things that you can do with the media of film. And I think this movie does it really well. There's a lot of moments where you understand what's happening without there needing to be a lot of conversation. So, you know, kudos to the writer and the director for managing to make that work.
You know, Eliza, your observation that we're seeing the men through the perspective of the women helps me a lot, because the men in general, if you just described them,
are, okay, they suck.
We can say it.
They're not the most functional group of men in the world, shall we say? And if you were to do not a rom-com about this small town, Sam Shepard's character is pathetic. He's mm-hmm. depressed.
Yeah.
He's unable to hold down a job. He was resentful of Dolly Parton's success with her salon. Spud is what they call him. You know, Malin's husband, Drum, is mm-hmm. purposefully odd. You know, so if you were to do a different kind of movie, these men would seem pathetic. But through the eyes of the women who have relationships with them, you see both their good and bad points.
Mm-hmm.
You see that Truvy's husband cares deeply about her, and over the course of the movie understands that he cares deeply and wants to be functional. Drum, despite trying to explode all of the birds out of the trees, is doing it because he wants his daughter's wedding to be beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and he wants his wife to be happy. And each of the men have a moment where you see the goodness in them and you see mm-hmm. why the women are with them. But as a whole, men are not well represented in the film.
No.
Yeah, even Jackson, Shelby's husband, is sort of, mm-hmm. I don't, what, one of the things that I think is maybe a misstep in the translation from the play to the film is that our sense of Jackson's, his role in the decision to get pregnant biologically and, mm-hmm. and have Shelby go through the birthing process, even though medically it is not advisable, or rather like something that her doctors are discouraging, it's really unclear. So I feel like Jackson, even though he's not as quirky as Spud and Drum, God mm-hmm. love those names, he also sort of feels feckless and uninvested in what's going on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's definitely a bit of a wet blanket. And I think a lot of, you know, what the movie is saying about these women is that this is a matriarchy, right? Like, these women
100%.
Run everything. And it puts it out there in subtle ways and in not so subtle ways. Right at the beginning, when we meet Olympia Dukakis's character, they say that she's the wife of the recently deceased former mayor. And she's just come from being at some grand opening of the new park in town or whatever, mm-hmm. right? So she's already established as a political figure in the town, right? And they talk about her having money. They talk about Weezer having money and the two of them figuring out as now single women what to do with their money. There's, you know, there's a lot of the women running things. We begin with one of the major things that women in our culture run, a wedding, right? Like, talk about institutions that are being run by the females in the community. That every single woman in town is dealing with this wedding and getting it ready. And the guys are just doing what the women have told them to do and driving the women crazy. And right, I mean, like, it's about the women running things in ways that often are very comedic, but also in ways that I think once you get to Sally Field's character, when you deal with Malin, is really a very deep thing that they're dealing with. I mean, every scene that she has to be this grounded strength for everyone around her in a way that by the end of the film you see is sort of destroying her from the inside.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Eliza. I think that metaphor that people always respond to in this movie, the idea that these women are delicate as magnolias and tough as steel. You're mm-hmm. right. I mean, there's a way that you could read that as being really unfair to women because it's asking you to be both delicate and fragile and impossibly strong at the same time, which is, everyone should hear this, not possible. It's very difficult. And it's rude
Thanks
to expect
clarifying.
People to do that. Just to be clear to anyone who holds that as a belief, it's not very nice.
I just feel so much for Sally Field in this movie because every time, you know, they're having this big wedding and everyone's happy and everyone's dancing and she's trying to have this conversation with her new son-in-law mm-hmm. about taking her daughter's medical issues seriously. You know, and her daughter tells everyone she's pregnant, and the dad's doing a toast and making jokes about he's going to have my good looks, and the brothers are, you know, shooting off fireworks, and she's having to have a conversation with her daughter about, like, okay, but what does this mean? Because I'm really worried about you. You know, and it just sort of time and time again, she is this lovely, warm person. You see her interacting with her friends and laughing and gossiping, but she has to always sort of return to that motherly, I've got this grounded thing.
Well, and the thing that I found so interesting this time around is I spent a lot of time watching the women physically. Because, you know, Weezer gets to just be all over the place, dragged by the dog and throwing tomatoes at people. And Annelle, who we'll get to later, goes through major physical transformations throughout the movie. And Sally Field is like a tightly wound ball the entire time until the end. No spoiler alerts if you haven't seen the movie. but her physical presence is so different from everybody else's. And you occasionally see her loosen it up when they're in the beauty salon. You occasionally see it like at the end of the wedding when she smiles. But for most of the time, she's just like somebody who is holding it together. And that's actually something that I know a lot of women deal with, particularly mothers, people who have responsibility for people's lives. You often see them really looking like, okay, if one thing goes wrong, the whole ball of yarn is going to unravel.
Absolutely. Well, and they make all those jokes about her hair being a football helmet. You know, her daughter says, just make it a football helmet. And all of them have big hair, but hers is very sort of contained within the bigness of it. And in the end, right before she has her big emotional breakdown, she looks in the mirror to check her makeup and she goes, oh, Shelby was right. It's a big football helmet. And I think there's something there too about, right, like she's so contained and so, you know, she's just got to be exact and strong and like steel all the time. And that's hard.
It's really hard. And I think that you can tell that this is a screenplay adapted by the playwright, you can also tell that it is something written by someone who is really from this area and grew up in this culture. And Robert Harling did. He's from Northwest Louisiana. This is based on his family. And the culture of women in the South, particularly in this part of the South, where you have to always act as if everything is fine. The way that you navigate when things are not fine is that to the outside world, you laugh, you make jokes. There's a really good example of this in the first scene in the beauty shop where Shelby and her mother are fighting about the wedding, but they're doing it through jokes. So you don't really read it like that, but they are absolutely fighting.
Colors are pink and pink.
They're blush and bashful. Pink is my signature color.
Oh yeah, exactly. They are fighting, right? But that's the funny thing is that like it's all surface level fun and you don't really understand that it's going poorly except for in the subtext until something really serious happens. And so when Shelby has her hypoglycemic episode, the whole house of cards falls, like Esther was saying. The whole thing unravels, and then everyone gets down to being very serious and very direct all of a sudden, and it's very stark.
But until everything falls apart, this movie's really funny.
My God. The dialogue.
One of the things I love about this movie that's both so funny and really lends to the authentic nature of the movie are all of the little phrases that they throw out, those little sort of idioms and words of wisdom. You know, she says at one point, like, my daddy says an ounce of pretension is worth a pound of manure. And, you know, and then Clarice says, I love you more than I love my luggage. You know, just all these kind of things that they're so funny, but they also are very dear and very sort of homey. And
there is no such thing as natural beauty.
Oh my God. She is also, this cast, in addition to the dialogue being so funny, this is an incredible cast. I mean, all the way through, the main cast of women is truly unbelievable. There is not a weak link in this whole ensemble of women. I mean, my goodness. My goodness.
Well, the cast together has something like 9 Oscar wins and 12 Oscar nominations.
Well, and the thing that's interesting when you think about the performers is that Julia Roberts was very young. This was really early in her career. Dolly Parton had been in films, but mostly being Dolly Parton.
Right.
And then we have people like Olympia Dukakis and
Sally Field.
I I mean, great, wonderful, talented, experienced performers. And to get that kind of ensemble work with that vast difference in experience is very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all the little background bits, all the guys do great too. You know, her two younger brothers, who I think have combined a grand total of 6 lines in the movie. But they're great. Every moment they're in, you get this sense of family. You totally get what their relationship is with their sister. They're funny. They've got all these little bits where they're like making faces at each other behind Weezer's back. And I mean, it really adds to everything.
Well, and Shirley MacLaine.
Can we just talk about Shirley MacLaine?
I think this is her best movie. I know she's done a lot of fabulous and important work, but her as Weezer is just her at just peak Shirley MacLaine. The scene where she walks into the church, and after several scenes of saying, like, I'm not into this guy that you've introduced me to, I'm not dating him, I don't know him, whatever, you see her walk in with this sort of, like, mean mug on, and then she winks at him. I just fell over. I was like, this is peak Shirley MacLaine perfection.
It's amazing. Well, and I kept thinking as we were watching it this time around, this movie is like a masterclass in character entrances.
Ooh, yes.
Your introduction to every character is so perfect. Your introduction to Drummond, your introduction to Annelle as she's walking through the town looking all scared, and when you get that introduction to Weezer, when Shirley MacLaine's running across the street, wrangling this giant dog, tripping over her bags, shouting across the... I mean, it is... such an entrance. She must have had so much fun milking that moment for all it's worth.
Well, and her character, Weezer and Drum, and that battle that they have throughout the entire film, mm-hmm. that they both actually are enjoying.
Absolutely.
He's visibly enjoying it.
Right. Which I think is realistic of those kind of male-female, you know, they've got almost this like sibling type thing. Mm-hmm. And I think about when my brother and I fought when we were kids, he was having fun being cruel to me and I was getting all up in arms and blah, blah, blah. But like we both loved it, right? And it's that same thing.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's that same thing, right? They just like, and like you said about loyalty, I think she's incredibly loyal to Drum. I think when, you know, when the chips are down and when they're dealing with, you know, this family tragedy at the end, she's got this moment at the funeral where she just kind of bumps him and he sort of nods and they walk away. And that's her being like, look, we'll argue tomorrow, but today I'm family. I'm here for you.
Yeah. The way that they show up for each other at various points and in different ways in the film is really beautiful. Like we were talking about before, the scene where Shelby Drum really announces for Shelby that she's pregnant and Malin goes off to another room and the women all come in and they're like, oh, Malin, this is wonderful. The doctor said that Shelby couldn't have children. And Malin clarifies, no, it's not that she couldn't, it's that she shouldn't. And all of the women you can see in their faces realize what that means. And they're just sitting with her and they have that scene where they put their hands on top of each other, just sitting together. It's just such a beautiful show of camaraderie. And again, to like take it back to Southern culture, a thing that this movie gets really right about the South and women in the South particularly is that sometimes if you're not from the South, you get these stereotypes about women who, you know, do these like passive aggressive, like I'm nice to your face, but I'm mean behind your back. But of course, there's a difference. There's the people that you talk shit about and the people that you talk shit with. And these are the people that they talk shit with. So it's like a diehard family. I will talk smack to your face, but I love you and I would do anything for you. And you know it and I know it.
But you know, when they do talk shit about other women, it's pretty funny.
Oh, I mean, you can't even really enumerate all the times that they're talking smack both about each other and other women in the town.
Right.
Like that scene where they see the woman at Shelby's reception, she's wearing that tight dress, and they say that it looks like two pigs fighting under a blanket. Every time, I just laugh until I cry.
Well, and then Truvy says, like, I haven't been out of the house without a girdle since I was 14. And Three says,
you were raised right.
Like, that tells you so much about their whole, like, world mindset. But also, what I do really, really enjoy about this movie is that it is not insulting to the women. I mean, the women individually insult each other, but their interest in stereotypically feminine things, their interest in hair and makeup and looking good and worrying about the pink roses is never shown in a bad light. This movie celebrates the joy of those things. It does not, you know, speak down to them or patronize them because this is what they worry about. And in fact, you know, early on, you see them, you know, it starts on an Easter and it ends on an Easter. And they're all making these eggs and loading them into the car and talking about the parade and talking about the wedding. And then at the end, you have this huge community scene where everyone's at the Easter event, right? And, like, these things are important. They're not frivolous.
Well, and when they have the... We were laughing at the Christmas carnival because that doesn't happen in the Northeast. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's a little cold for that.
Yeah, meanwhile, we're out here boiling shrimp and wearing, like, denim jackets. It's December 21st.
Yeah, no, we don't get that. But the Christmas carnival looked great.
Oh, yeah.
But when Shelby says, I wouldn't miss this, I came home because I wouldn't miss this, you absolutely believe that because she wouldn't. This is where her family is. This is where her friends are. This is where her husband's family is. Of course they wouldn't miss this. This is a big event in their lives.
Well, and she goes over to where they're, you know, doing the crab boil, and she gets some iced tea and whatever, and she starts to pay. And Annelle, who doesn't actually know her that well because Annelle's only been in town for 6 months, is like, put your money away. Are you kidding me? Like, she's just become a part of this family immediately as well. Mm-hmm. They've adopted her, and in kind, she adopts them.
Okay, but let's talk about Annelle.
Yes, let's talk about Annelle's journey through the film. Wow, she goes on a real ride.
This is our third Daryl Hannah movie that we've talked about, and I just feel like she's really played some very different characters in the movies we've covered.
She either plays someone who is looked at as, like, kind of profoundly, like, naive and not dumb, but something like dumb, or, like, absolutely brilliant Amazon who, like, you know, has no faults. Which must have been very interesting for her as a young person in the film industry. But let's talk about Annelle.
I mean, the thing I find, and the interest in Annelle at the very beginning is, of course, the fact that these women take her in right away. Mm-hmm. Truvy sizes her up very quickly. She knows there's something weird going on, but she is too polite and too Southern to ask that question. And she's talking to her in a professional light first. You know, is the hair too poofy? Oh, I can tell a bottle job from a, you know, 1,000 paces usually. So she's trying to slowly suss her out. Then Weezer comes in and just cuts to the chase.
Yeah.
Like,
right away. Where's your husband?
What do you mean you don't know whether you're married or not? But even when they understand that she does have kind of a sketchy past and that things aren't good, they still bring her in and they make her part of the family. They size her up right away as being somebody who needs a family, and they provide that to her. And then they're kind to her through all of her iterations.
Well, and she's a great character because I feel like we all know someone like this or have been someone like this. She's trying on different hats to see what fits. And a lot of those things are what she's seeing around her, but she sort of goes too hard with everything, right? Like, it's implied that she sort of has a real party girl phase very briefly, and then it's like, oh, that's terrible. And then she, you know, starts going to this, you know, Bible-thumping church and becomes very religious. And it's been established throughout the movie, all of them go to church, all of them, you know, talk about the town being a, you know, a religious town, we're all good Christians, but she goes to the point where they're like, please stop talking about this. She prays at the drop of a hat, her boyfriend's sick of it, but they let her be her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, and it, that dichotomy of them sort of being like, we also go to church, but, like, maybe you go to church too much.
And also, to her boyfriend's credit, Sammy is one of the more interesting men in the movie, I think, and that's not saying a whole lot. But it is interesting, just saying,
yeah.
God loves Sam Shepard, and I'll talk about that for a long time, about him being in this movie. But Sammy, you know, he shows up and he meets her at the wedding and he immediately is into her. He makes it very clear that he's into her. But through all of her iterations, he sticks through it. You know, he voices his frustration when she pours his beer out, but he sticks with it. And by the end of the film,
they get married a couple months later.
Exactly. Like, and they have a baby and everything. And it's a really interesting portrayal of a relationship over time because it's not perfect, but they stick with each other through it. And that's actually a really healthy depiction, I think. And not necessarily what I expected, not what I remembered about that relationship in film. I kind of expected them to break up.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I do think that the men and women in this story exist on different planes.
100%.
Right? Like we said, the women are running everything and the men are each just dealing with their own personal shit and kind of, like, they're totally useless. And they touch on that in the movie. You know, Sally Field has that line where she's like, when it really got serious, the boys left, my husband left, her husband left. Like, you know, they know the men are not who you rely on in an emergency. But they are they all are trying. And you get these little bits of it here and there where they're like trying to make an effort and trying to figure out how to connect with these women. And even in the very last scene when they're all at the Easter picnic and Annelle goes into labor and the whole town like jumps into it and they jump her in a car and Drum starts driving her away. And it's, I had noticed this, but I always forget this. It's Truvy's shitty son who they spend the whole movie making fun of, who gets his motorcycle and lets Sammy, the husband whose wife is now in labor, get on the back of his motorcycle and takes off for the hospital. And I loved that detail because all you hear about this character the whole movie is like, he's got this girlfriend who I don't like and he's covered in tattoos and he's always on his motorcycle.
I have met his girlfriend and the only good thing I can say about her is all her tattoos are spelled correctly.
Right. But he's still a part of this town and this community and he still is like, get on my bike. We're going to get you to the hospital. Don't worry. I got you, man. And like the guys are trying. They're just very bad at it.
Yes. And they are. They're like almost comic relief in this movie because it's funny. This movie, and I assume this play, they're not, they're kind, this film's reputation has become that it is a rom-com and therefore we treat it like a rom-com, but structurally it's actually more like a melodrama and the play mm-hmm. is too. So these men kind of serve as comic relief because they are so like feckless in a way. And they do show up when it matters, but it is funny that, that unlike some other rom-coms where there's like a funny best friend character who serves as the comic relief, who's usually a woman. In this case, all of the men are the comic relief and Weezer.
Yeah, and Weezer.
Although it is interesting that you say that about, you know, the Truvy's son showing up at the end. The depiction of motherhood in this movie and the depiction of their relationship with their children is quite complicated when you think about it, because I had forgotten that Weezer had children until I watched this movie, but she is estranged from them. Mm-hmm. She's had two awful husbands. She has three children she never sees. And then there's somebody like Malin and Shelby who can't get out of each other's faces, who are so closely tied to each other that one's life is essentially the other's life. And then there's everything in between. There's, and some of it's to comic effect and not. But I really found that to be quite realistic. Mm-hmm. That there are people who have extended families with whom they do not have a relationship. And so for Weezer, this is her family.
Right. Mm. Well, and even Malin and Shelby, you know, Malin clearly, they've got the sort of family unit, right? You see them in the house a lot. You see them, you know, all dealing together. But she has a different relationship with Shelby than she has with the two boys. You know, the boys belong to their dad and Shelby belongs to her mom. And that's very clear. And again, I think that's realistic. I think that happens a lot of times where, you know, different parents connect with different kids or the women just all go off and do their own thing while the guys go off and do their own thing. But it's so interesting, especially for them, because their lives are so connected and they, you know, she can't do anything without her Shelby and Shelby can't do anything without her mom's approval. And then like there's these two brothers just sort of running off in the background who they're ignoring 90% of the time.
Just going to be exactly like Drum, just wild, blowing off fireworks in the trees. That's who they're going to be. But the relationship between Malin and Shelby reminds me of, I did some research around the like conversation about this film. Cause I had never thought about it in a critical way. Cause it's just such a classic of my youth. But the one criticism that I've seen that's got a kind of serious tone to it is a criticism for how Shelby's diabetes is treated in the film and the kind of way that they talk about her choice to have children, even though her disability is going to put her life in peril because of it. And I'm wondering what you both think about it. I'm not sure how I feel about it personally, to be honest, because I don't have a disability and I don't have a family member with a disability. But I do know that the playwright wrote this about his sister's death. So Shelby's story is really based on something that truly happened in his family. And other people have said that it's sort of, the film is suggesting that people who, you know, decide to give birth, even though they have life-threatening disabilities or impairments, are being selfish or something. I don't know if I read it that way, but I'm curious what you both think about it.
I mean, I definitely think the conversation around disability is very different today than it was when this movie came out. You know, even in what's not that long a period of time, I think just how we discuss that in, you know, sort of our, you know, social circles right now has changed. Mm. But I think that, yes, there is a lot of you know, sort of interesting ways that they talk about what her disability means, but this is from the perspective of her family and her friends, and it is about how it affects them and how it affects her. You know, and you're seeing it from her mother's perspective, her mother who wants to protect her, and she's having to say, look, I can't be protected anymore. I'm an adult. I'm going to make these decisions. They might be the right ones. They might be the wrong ones. And I don't think at the end the movie has made a decision about if it was the right or the wrong choice, you know?
You know, I think that I agree. This is a, the movie was made in 1989. Our understanding and our public dialogue about disability has changed a lot in that time. But I think that as a parent, and this is somebody, Shelby's character has had juvenile diabetes. So she's had type 1 diabetes probably from a very, very young age. They, you know, she probably was diagnosed quite early. And Malin's job was to keep her alive, which is functionally different from somebody who might have a hearing impairment or somebody who might have a mobility impairment. You would certainly have the same sort of emotional response to that. But that might be much more about how do I help my child achieve independence with this physical issue that they must deal with for the rest of their lives. Malin understands very early that it's actually life and death. And also the other piece here is that Shelby's young.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't give her an age, but she's young. She's like 22,
yeah,
right?
I think Julia Roberts was 22 when she filmed it.
I mean, she clearly has been to nursing school. So at least she's had 2 years of, you know, getting her nursing degree. Malin has spent 20 years ensuring that this child lives.
Yeah.
And so to hand that responsibility off to your clearly not particularly responsible 20-year-old who thinks blush and bashful are her signature colors, you know, it's quite emotionally challenging. And whether Shelby has made the right decision or not, Malin's focus is, I'm supposed to keep you alive, and I can't do that anymore. So I understand why the external dialogue might be challenging, but as a parent, I totally understand Malin. Whether I would do it or not is a different question.
Right. Well, and I think as a community, they do treat Shelby fairly normally. You know, that scene right at the beginning when they're first at the beauty salon and Shelby has an attack, they all jump right into it. Clearly, again, they've been dealing with this for years. They know what it looks like. You know, Clarice is like, I'll get the juice. I'll get the candy. They jump right up. But Anel, who's not used to it, is like, should I do anything? Can I help? What, blah, blah, blah. And Malin says, no, normalcy is very important. And once they get her to calm down, then Truvy just fixes her hair, right? Like they have clearly as a group decided this is how we deal with it. We deal with the problem. Then we go right back to how things were and it's okay. You know, and again, you see that control that Sally Field has to have that whole time, that Malin has to be able to, you know, her daughter's having this moment and she has to stay in control and take care of it and talk her down and get her juice and then fix everything. And she's been having to be like that for, you know, whatever it is, 15, 20 years, right? Like, she can't show any cracks because this is her job.
One of the things I was interested in reading about this criticism and thinking about everything that you're both talking about was looking at the history of how type 1 diabetes was treated, because, of course, it's come a long way since the 80s. And one of the things I was reading was that the issue of women with type 1 diabetes giving birth was very contentious before 1985 or so, just because doctors were mostly male doctors, frankly, were telling women like, it's not safe for you to give birth, therefore you shouldn't, instead of saying like, let's find new ways for you to give birth that are safe for you. And eventually there was a woman OBGYN who made it her sort of mission to make it safer for women with type 1 diabetes to give birth. And now there's still, risks and stuff, as there is with any high risk pregnancy, but it is much less fatal than it was. And so it was interesting for me too to think about how at this time a person with type 1 diabetes would have been more profoundly impaired, more profoundly disabled than perhaps now, just because the treatment is so different. So it's also interesting to think about, like you were saying, Eliza, like treating someone with type 1 diabetes as normal, like, to me felt like, oh, but they, like, that's a very manageable disability. And then I remembered, like, oh, but, you know, there was a time when it really wasn't, when it was very life-threatening. huh. You know, it's good to remember that history too when watching this movie, I think.
I think it's a challenge whenever you see a movie, you know, one or two generations after, because you don't really have perspective on what was actually going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that treatments have absolutely improved in treatment of something like diabetes. And yet these are systemic diseases that mm-hmm. can affect all of the organs in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, so if this is 1989 and Shelby was born in 1969, those treatments didn't exist.
Right. Well, and it's interesting what you say about that history, that, you know, all these male doctors were saying, oh, you can't do this, so that's the end of it. And as we know, this happens historically over and over and over again in modern Western medicine, is that women's opinions, women's needs, women's difficulties are undervalued and under-researched. It's still happening today. For example, and we were talking about this just the other day, the vaccine for the coronavirus, they didn't study if it had an effect on menstrual periods.
Right.
And it turns out it does.
Whoops.
And no one across the world in the last year thought to look into that. And it's mostly okay. You know, it's just whatever. People are having worse symptoms. But this is still happening where they say, oh, that's just what it is. Women will just have to deal with that. You know, they have all of these birth control, you know, versions of birth control that give women terrible symptoms. And they say, like, but that's, if you want to be able to have sex and not have kids, this is your only option. And that can't be true. But this is what happens with medicine. And, you know, and so I think that conversation of, do we blame someone for wanting to live a normal life and have a kid and blah, 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 just because medicine hasn't caught up to the point where that will be, you know, quote unquote, easy. Or do we have a longer conversation about, okay, what do we have to adjust to make it easier for this person to do this thing that, of course, they are, you know, perfectly within their rights to want to do?
Yeah, like Shelby has that line where she tells her mom as a reassurance, like, I would rather have 30 minutes of wonderful than a lifetime of nothing special. And that's not to say, and I don't think the film is implying this, that's not to say that, like, adoption or surrogacy or whatever mm-hmm. is not a lifetime of nothing special. But for Shelby, in her particular position, wonderful was having a biological child that she gave birth to. And that's her right. You know, it's her body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's a line in the movie that really shows me a sensitivity to Shelby's perspective, you know, in a way that I think is affirming to her as a person with a disability that I really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I will say, I don't think this movie looks down on the idea of adoption or surrogacy or, you know, that kind of thing, because I think so many of the women in this movie have adopted Shelby.
Yeah.
You know, right? Like, as we said, there's a lot of different versions of what motherhood looks like in this movie, but all of the older women are very kind to Shelby, are very kind to Annelle. They take them in, they look after them, they look after each other. You know, Clarie, we never hear anything about her having kids. As far as we know, she does not. But that certainly hasn't stopped her from being this motherly figure in the town and to her friends' kids. You know, and I think that you don't have to spell it out for there to be a broader conversation about different types of family.
And speaking of that, can we talk about Clarie and Weezer?
Yes!
I think this time when I watched it, I really realized that as a group, they are friends, they are family, they are loyal. But the only really friends, like mm-hmm. long-term, know each other from childhood, give each other the kind of crap you can only give to your best friend, are Clarie and Weezer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they are great.
Well, and they do nothing but bicker, but they also do everything together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Shelby and her mom are in the hospital because they're dealing with the kidney transplant, the two of them go to the grocery store together to pick up all of the food to make food to leave at the house for Drum. Right? Like, that's not something you just do with another woman in town. That's something you do with your best friend, the person who, at this point in your life, for all intents and purposes, is your partner.
And the way that they talk to each other is so perfect, right? Like the famous scene where, you know, Malin is having a very well-earned breakdown about Shelby's death, and she says she wants to hit something, and Clarie just throws Weezer in front of her and says, here, hit this, hit Weezer, just slap her as hard as you can, and Weezer just gets so upset. But it's such a perfect encapsulation of their friendship that Clary just is like, we're going to survive this. It's fine. Hit Weezer. You know, and she's making a joke, but she's also being serious at the same time. And then the conversation that they have afterwards about, you know, I love you more than my luggage. The way that they talk to each other that is just so, it's the kind of way that you talk to someone who you're not afraid of losing over something small. You know, like that's a person that you are deeply intertwined with in a very beautiful way.
Absolutely. There's no, they don't have to say, I forgive you. They know it's going to happen. And they're still a little angry about what they did to each other. I mean, seriously, she says, take a whack of Weezer.
So rude.
Well, and then they're on this bench in the garden and they're like hip checking each other and pushing each other off the bench. These two, like what, 70-year-old women are at a funeral, are just like shoving each other off of a garden bench.
Olympia Dukakis and Shirley MacLaine are a study in acting that everybody should watch. Mm-hmm. They're just amazing.
And we have to say, most unfortunately, as we were recording this episode, Olympia Dukakis just died. Yeah. So, you know, if you haven't watched a lot of movies with Olympia Dukakis, go and watch all of them right now. Because it's a study in acting for sure.
Greatest name in the world.
Yes. Really? What a great name.
Can we talk about the names in this movie briefly before we wrap things up?
Oh my gosh. The southern names in this movie.
Listen.
Weeza Boudreaux.
That.
And you know, Drummond Eatonton.
Well, and I really want to know what Malin stands for. Is she Mary Lynn?
That's my guess.
Or is that her name?
My guess is that it's short for Mary Lynn because Weezer is short for Louisa.
Which is made clear in one scene where someone says Louisa and you go, oh.
Right. Yeah, I think that a lot of these are nicknames. Like Truvy's got to be a nickname for something too, but I don't know what. And that's what, it's very right. true of Southern culture to have these kind of nicknames that are very specific. Like the whole movie I kept thinking about some of my family members. Like I have a family member who we call Tika, which is short for Harriet. How? I don't know. I have a relative who we call Chick, or we used to call Chick, and her name was Chikora. So you absorb all of these nicknames and you forget what their given names are because they don't matter. It's the same with the men, right? Spud's not his name. Who knows what his actual name is, but it's certainly not Spud.
Yeah, we do not know.
Spud and Drum.
And I also have to give a shout out to the writer of this who perfectly captured the politics of when to and when not to call someone Miss First Name. That is an art, and it is a lived-in linguistic thing. There are only some times where you call someone Miss Malin and Miss Weezer, but not always. It is a sign of respectful affection, but you don't always use it. It's only in very specific instances that are very difficult to parse out if you're not raised natively in that southern sort of dialect. So kudos to this movie for getting the Miss thing right.
I think in any culture there are those sort of understood things when you call someone Miss or Mr. blah blah blah, when you call someone by their first name or their last name or their nickname, and I know in the South it is very complex and very sort of set in stone, and yeah, they get this. And you know, Annelle comes in, and of course at first she's calling everyone Miss whatever because she's just met them and she's feeling, you know, very much beneath them. Mm-hmm. And by the end that's not the issue.
Well, even the boys call Weezer Miss Weezer to her face.
Right.
Of course, you know, not to her face. They say other things, but
but yeah, they at one point like push by her at one of the parties and they go, excuse me, Miss Weezer. You know, and like they're being completely rude. They're knocking her over practically into the pool, but like you still gotta say Miss Weezer.
That's the funny thing about that practice is that because Southern linguistics are so funny, like sometimes it's legit and totally like meaningful like respect, and other times when you say Miss Weezer you're being rude, and that was a way that they were being rude, which is hilarious. And it's all about tone and context.
Also, I feel like, and I mean obviously I am not an expert in Louisiana accents, but I feel like the accents are pretty good in this movie too, because they all sound similar. You know, a lot of times when you get a movie in the South that stars not everyone who's actually from the South, it's sort of a melange of vaguely Southern accents. And some of them are from North Carolina and some of them are from Texas.
I will say that everybody kind of nailed it except for Julia Roberts, which is interesting because she's from Georgia. But this is actually probably why. Because she leaned too hard on the soft ahs instead of the r's. Mm. And this is me nitpicking. But in Northwest Louisiana, which is very close to the Texas-Arkansas border, you would definitely have hard r's. And Shirley MacLaine does that very well in particular.
I will say the one scene that Eliza and I particularly enjoyed, but that I thought was the most naturalistic and realistic scene in the whole movie was the card game just before Shelby goes off to have her surgery.
The transplant jokes. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Our family has had our own medical problems, and as we have been through them, our frame of reference for what is and isn't an appropriate joke to make in public definitely went out the window.
But the other piece to that is, that was the scene where you really saw Drum
mm-hmm.
as a human being.
Yes.
As a caring, loving parent. Because all the rest of the time he's playing it up. He's just like doing his shtick. And they're sitting around getting their stress out, relieving their anxiety about the following day by making the kinds of jokes that siblings make. And that family members make, and he can't do it.
Yeah.
He can't do it. He's so upset, and they understand that and can't help themselves.
They keep making the jokes anyway. But yeah, you know, this is clearly a family that has conversations entirely in joking and teasing one another. This is how they relate to each other. But in this moment, he's so emotionally strung out that he can't deal with it. And it's a lovely moment to see, because normally it's the other way around. With him and Malin, and Malin has decided that she's gonna let her guard down, and almost because she's done that, he can then step up and be the serious one, or vice versa, right? Like, she sees how serious he is and knows that she has to, you know, loosen up a bit in retaliation, and it really shows you so much about their marriage and their relationship.
Yeah, and it should be said that this play, I didn't realize until doing research for this episode, but, and you know, I'm sure a lot of people are going to be surprised to hear that this was adapted from a play, but this play ran for over 1,000 performances in New York. It had a West End run. It's been done in countries all over the world, including France and Japan. So this play is kind of major.
And, you know, shout out to the playwright. We talk a lot on this podcast about how you can tell when a woman is written by a man. And this is one of those movies where I don't walk away with that impression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think he really understood the women in his life. And whether that's that he just naturally did or that he really had to work on it when he was writing the play, I don't know. But the interactions between the women feel very authentic and very natural. And that's hard to do.
Yeah. Shout out to Robert Harling. Well done.
Cheers.
This time, everyone, we'd like to take some time to thank our lovely patrons on Patreon. It's so rare that we actually have one of our patrons with us, so this is fun. We especially love to shout out our romantic leads on Patreon, who are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. Thank you so much for your support.
If you want to come to our beauty salon and talk shit with us any day of the week, you should like us on Facebook and Instagram. Follow us. Let us know your thoughts on this movie, any of the other movies, or become one of our patrons at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Well, Esther and Eliza, I feel pretty strongly that we're going to be doing supplements this week and not antidotes. So I throw it out to you. Esther, you're our guest today. So what are your supplements for Steel Magnolias?
My supplement for Steel Magnolias is a dark comedy called Drop Dead Gorgeous. This is a 1999 comedy. It also has an incredible cast.
Yes.
And many of them are TV and film people that you have seen, but also does have sort of a shout out to the theater types. It's a dark comedy about a small town Southern community. It is not quite as middle class as is being portrayed in Steel Magnolias. I think trailer trash would, in fact, be the appropriate term for many people. And it is about a small-town beauty pageant and the terrible things that happen to many of the women who are involved in the pageant. And I'm not going to say anything more than that, because it's really a movie to be seen. But I will say that the cast is terrific. Kirstie Alley and Ellen Barkin are the mother figures in this movie, along with Allison Janney, who is the best friend in a movie you can ever see. I had remembered that Kirsten Dunst and Denise Richards were in it. I had totally forgotten that among the people participating in the beauty pageant were Brittany Murphy and Amy Adams.
Yes. They're both so young.
Who are so young and so fabulous. And just as a side note, this movie was in fact Eliza's grandmother's favorite movie. And that tells you everything you need to know about our family.
Janelle, we did the math, and this movie came out when my grandmother was 70. Which means that my 70-year-old grandmother went to the movie theater, watched Drop Dead Gorgeous, and was like, that is my favorite movie.
I think that is the most fabulous thing I've ever heard in my life.
Well, I was trying to think of something to suggest as a supplement to this. And what I was thinking of is what I really love about this movie, you know, beyond just the comedy, is that feeling that you get when all the women are in a room just chatting. And so I was thinking about a movie that I watched recently, movie, documentary, whatever you want to call it, which is Tea with the Dames, or Nothing Like a Dame, which is actually the name that it was released in the UK with. And it is a like 90-minute piece that features a conversation in a garden with dames Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Eileen Atkins, and Joan Plowright. And it's just the four of them talking about their careers. And, you know, there's a director who sort of prompts them, but mostly it's just sort of them talking about, well, when I did Juliet, and when I did Ophelia, and, well, when I got married, then I had the kids, and that changed this, and working with this director was like this. And these women are so funny and so interesting. And they've all hit that age where they kind of don't give a shit, and they're willing to say anything. And at one point he asks them something about their age, and Judi Dench just looks straight at the director and says, fuck off. And it's a really enjoyable thing to sit down for a few hours and watch, because they're just very interesting women who have had these amazing careers in the theater and film world, and also have, you know, reached this level within English, you know, the English hierarchy of being named dames for their contributions to the arts. And it's very fun.
Obviously, my supplements for this film are just, like, vast. I had to actually peel them down because there's so many things that I think can enrich your watching experience of this movie. But the first one I'll start with is that one of my favorite, like, small details of this movie, besides the armadillo cake, which is, to this day, one of the best things I've ever seen in a movie ever. Like, it's so fantastic and dark and awful and wonderful. also at Shelby's wedding reception, there's a scene where two people are doing some like really fabulous Zydeco dancing, which is kind of a dance form that mm-hmm. comes from Louisiana, from Creole and Cajun communities. And there's a really good YouTube video called Zydeco Dance in Houston, Black Cowboys, Trail Rides, and Creole Roots. And I am a native Houstonian, so I got a lot of strong feelings about that kind of Louisiana-Houston in exchange. But I also think it's a really good video about how great of a influence like Black and Creole and Indigenous communities have on that culture, on the Louisiana culture, and on Zydeco dance and that music in particular. And this film, you know, it doesn't have any people of color in it, but that presence and that influence of culture is there, and it's making itself known. So learn more about Zydeco. It's really interesting. But really, my supplements are about playwrights. So we love Robert Harling, and he did such a great job writing the women in this play. But I want to give a shout out and expand your horizons about contemporary women playwrights who write about the South and Appalachia. And the first one that I want to suggest is Kia Corthron. Kia Corthron mm-hmm. is from Maryland, but the Appalachian part of Maryland. And she has a gorgeous play called Come Down Burning, which is about two sisters living in Appalachia, one of whom is disabled. It's beautiful. It's heartbreaking. It's triumphant and lyrical. Just go read it. Go read anything Kia Corthron has written. And then I also want to shout out my colleague in the DC theater scene, Audrey Cephaly, who's from Alabama, and her 2017 play, The Gulf, which is about two queer women in Alabama going on a fishing trip. It is dark. It is totally engaging. It just like grips you and doesn't let you go. It's a fabulous play. So yeah, just start reading more plays written by women like Kia Corthron and Audrey Cephaly.
Well, happy Mother's Day to any mothers who are out there.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day, Esther.
Thank you.
Anyone with a mother out there, give her a call, tell her happy Mother's Day. Go watch this movie.
Watch this movie with your mom or mother figure. It's so good.
Hold each other while you sob through the last hour.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time. Start some kissing and making